Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Well, we're really going to geek out today, dear listeners, because we have with us today is someone who is widely seen as an influencer in our profession, Matthew Butterick, the author of Typography for Lawyers, among other things. Matthew, thank you for being with us.
Yes.
My pleasure.
Well, a lot of our listeners obviously will know your name because we see it in print quite a lot. Your book and your website that we'll get into later are referenced frequently in terms of how to go about making positive changes in terms of the readability of briefs as justification, arguably, for some of the rules that we argue about on appellate Twitter all the time, which we'll talk about for sure too. But just so that the audience gets a chance to get to know you a little better, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you come from, and how you came up into the legal profession.
Sure. Well, typography was my first love before I got into the law. From just a lad to a teenager, I started getting interested in typography, mostly through the influence of 80s new wave album covers from England. That's true. And also Spy magazine. I don't know if anybody listening remembers that, but this is just like a typographically crazy thing that was like a communication from some advanced alien system. And I just thought, wow, that's so great what you can do with the typography and then the fonts. Of course, at the time, you know, making fonts was much harder. So I went to college, got a design degree. I didn't really do typography or font making as part of like my official degree, but in my residential dormitory, there was actually a letterpress shop in the basement. And for those of you who don't know that term, this is the oldest form of printing where you actually take movable type, which is cast in metal. You put it in the bed of a press, you ink it, and you roll paper over it. So that's really where I started to learn about, you know, typography. And I had a great teacher there who sort of spent time with me and showed me the ropes. And at the same time, though, kind of learning that really like the, not just old fashioned, the oldest fashion style of typography and working with type. I also got an early Mac computer. The font making tools were sort of becoming a little more usable. And so my education, as it were, typographically sort of proceeded along this like highly analog line and highly digital line. I worked as a digital type designer for a number of years, and then I kind of transitioned into doing web design in the 90s. And that all kind of wrapped up. And I thought, well, you know what? It's fun, but if I ever wanted to go back to grad school or something, this is probably the right moment. So I thought, well, should I go do computer science? Should I be a CPA? No, I bypassed all those and went to law school. So there you have it. So but when I came later, and in fact, I wasn't really planning to do typography again anytime soon. I'd always been interested in law. It's just that when I graduated from college, I'd had these opportunities to do typography, which were sort of unusual. And I thought, well, I should just do that for a while. So I was really kind of coming back to something that was interesting. Got my law degree, and I did practice for a couple of years. But, you know, along the way, in fact, it was my first semester of law school in the legal writing class, and we had our first assignment. And I thought, I know what I'll do. I won't file it in 12-point Courier. I'll actually put it in a decent font and with decent margins and the whole thing. And I got just slammed by the teacher. He said, why did you do this with all this typography? I said, what? I made it look nice. He's like, you don't do that in this class. It's 12-point Courier every day. And I said, okay. But I was angry, you know, in a good-natured way, the kind of anger that's like, I got to strike back against this. So it wasn't really painful thing. But I did eventually turn into, I think this was on 2008. So this is while I was practicing. I put up the first Typography for Lawyers website, and it was just kind of a collection of tips, again, that I brought forward from my experience as a typographer and designer and threaded through what you can do in the law. And I just thought it was going to be something that a few like-minded nerdy lawyers were into. So I was probably the most surprised of anyone that it blew up at that point. And since you had Jason Wilson on not too long ago, I'm sure he recounted the story, but you know, he approached me I think a couple of years after that and said, hey, why don't we turn this into a paperback? And I said, all right, I never thought anybody would care that much. So I feel like for now 10 years, been sort of chasing along behind this thing that just keeps snowballing. So it's been fun. And for me, the best part has been finding out how many lawyers are interested in this. And I think that sometimes people misunderstand my approach to the material if they haven't read the book. You know, they think I'm some whatever dude standing up on the top of Mount Typography, shaking his fist at the ignorant masses below. And it's not really that at all. I think that, you know, lawyers, of course, this isn't the premise of the book, that lawyers are publishers, right? And just like other publishers, we should take seriously how our work is presented. So I never try to convince lawyers that, you know, font choice or line spacing is more important than their argument. But at the same time, in pretty much every other area of legal practice, we do take pains to make sure our argument is presented well, right? If we do an oral argument in front of a judge or a panel, we've probably taken time to rehearse it and think about what points are we going to emphasize? What's our tone of voice, right? We don't want to be boring at the lectern. We've probably even gone through the trouble of putting on clean clothes because we don't want to show up to court with like a pizza stain on our shirt. And so that was kind of my early pitch. It's, if I don't have a problem convincing you of the value of laundry, why should I have a problem convincing you about typography? That said, there are some people who are sticks in the mud. You know, my favorite, I actually think that the story is at the end of the book where, because I used to do more CLEs and I would kind of move through the ranks, right? I'm doing like, you know, lunch talks at, you know, some little firm. And then, you know, eventually I'm up in here at Century City on the 24th floor with this big catered lunch. And, you know, one of these partners says, but Matthew, at the end of my presentation, that's all well and good, but what does any of this have to do with the practice of law? And I just thought, that's the craziest thing you've ever said to me, because everything else I've seen up to this point in the day has nothing to do with the practice of law, like your office building and your computers and your fancy cars and your security guards. And I mean, they had bomb sniffing dogs in the elevator. Nothing. It has nothing to do with the practice of law. So I don't know why for some people this is just sort of like comedy material, but fine. You know what? Either way, I'm fine with it, because to me, typography is a great secret weapon. I've been enjoying its benefits for, 30 plus years now. So to me, I'm good either way. Either I'm going to bring more people in the typography army, who, by the way, uniformly tell me how much value they get out of this material. Nobody has ever written to me and said, I read your book and used your tips and nothing happened. I've literally never gotten that email. Instead, it's just people, even if they're tentative, even if they're skeptical, they start trying to put these principles to work and they immediately start getting positive feedback from whatever it is, the supervising partner, the colleague, the client, the judge, the opposing counsel. Everybody notices. It never fails. So I just sit back and let that goodness wash over the people who are open to these ideas because they deserve it.
Well, that was one of my next questions, was how the material has been responded to. And I mean, that's been our experience, I think. I mean, even appellate lawyers, lawyers generally, and appellate lawyers in particular, we're not the quickest to change. But I think people started hearing your message, you know, really early on, and it caught some attention and started being talked about. And, you know, there are some things I think people resist that we'll get into here in a bit. But I think the response, from what I see, has been very positive. And not only that, but long lasting. I mean, this has been going on. You started with the website in 2008. As Jason Wilson takes credit for, you wrote a book at his urging, I guess, turned it into a book. I'm joking around about Jason. I have to give him a little bit of
credit. He can take credit. Yeah, the book would not exist if Jason hadn't suggested it. Absolutely. He deserves it.
But it's pervaded, I guess, in the legal culture, and we're still talking about it, and people still are referencing the book. But yet, we still see many examples of bad typography in legal writing. And so I guess what I'm saying, Matthew, is there's still work to do, even despite having written the book and talked about it for, you know, well over a decade now. There's still room for people to hear the message. And so that's one of the great things about our medium, is we're hoping to help spread the word.
It's like Brian Garner. He has to keep updating these books on usage because people keep getting things wrong. It's a long-term campaign to bring these messages in. And that's fine. And you know what? In the end, even at the best case, only a tiny fraction of lawyers are going to care. But that's okay with me too. You know, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. You mentioned appellate lawyers. Why is this? I agree with you. This has been particularly resonant with appellate lawyers. And why is that? And you two can maybe tell me. I mean, I have always surmised that the appellate lawyer, I guess two prongs. One is that the appellate lawyer is maybe naturally tends to be a slightly nerdier form of lawyer, like to kind of get in there with those messages of law. And so when somebody steps up with typography, it's like, ooh, what's this for my quiver of artillery? Please tell me more. And then the other part of it, which is very important, is the appellate lawyer often has more time in their schedule to sort of reflect on these things in a way that maybe people engaged at the trial level don't necessarily. So either you tell me though.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge.
I think both of those observations are correct. I think also, as appellate lawyers, our written product really is mostly our only chance to speak to the court. We don't have the hearings that trial lawyers have. Oral arguments are so severely limited that so much of our speaking to the court comes through the written product we present to them. So I think I don't want to say we take greater pride in it, but I think we take more pains to make sure that we present the best thing we can because we have more time, but also because we know it's kind of our only shot.
There's that. And I think we want our written product to look professional and to be legible and to be attractive to the reader. Those are all, you know, good reasons to pay attention to typography. And we're also, to some degree, looking for ways to distinguish our work from other people's. I mean, anybody can put together a brief that has the basic elements, but not just anybody without putting some time into it can put together a brief that someone like you or a court can look at and say, well, that is a really attractive document. It's easy to read. The font is not Courier, for goodness sakes. And so we're looking for ways to set ourselves apart. And so I think that was one reason why you found an audience among appellate lawyers pretty easily, I would say.
Well, it's a great audience. My wife, of course, was an appellate lawyer in private practice and then transitioned to working at the California Court of Appeal for a justice. But of course, being Mrs. Typography, it's funny though. When she started that job a number of years ago, she said, honey, I'm so excited to start my job at the state of California. I'm going to go in, you know, and get them to change all their typography. And I said, please, sweetie, don't do that. And this is my advice to everyone, like to the associates, to the law students who find my book in law school, like I'm taking this to my summer job and I'm going to, you know, like, don't, you know, just, that's the wrong thing. Like, nobody cares about your opinion on typography. And this is my life too. I said, don't, because they care about, they want to see you do your job first and foremost. So please, I don't want anyone to say that I emailed Matthew Boderick and he told me to go in with the typographic guns blazing. No. Just like I play it casually and quietly, so does everybody else. You just sort of have to make your, you know, where you can improve your own written product. And I tell you, people will notice. And your comment about the document is more attractive, I actually think this is a fear that a lot of lawyers have about this material, that somehow they're stepping into a world where they're competing on, oh, I made it too attractive. And now nobody sees my precious words. Like, that's not how it works. It's much more subliminal to that. I mean, again, imagine if you stepped up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court wearing a clown suit. You know, people would notice and it would stand out. And that's not really how it works. When you use a nice font and nice margins and all the other details, people just say, I'm happy to be with this document. I can tell that somebody spent some time on this. What are the things that people like to read? Whether it's, I don't know, is it the Wall Street Journal? Is it the New York Times? Is it the Washington Post? Whatever you like to read, is it New York Magazine? Is it the New Yorker? Is it Bloomberg Business Week? These are all publications that spend a lot of money on writing, a lot of money on editing, and also on design and typography, because their idea is, hey, the material's great, the material's wonderful and beautiful. Let's make sure that the outer beauty matches the inner beauty, and it's all kind of a piece. So again, though, I don't expect people to simply be convinced because I tell them, and I've never wanted that to be true. And that's part of why I've always had a lot of the material up on the web, it's like, please don't take my word for it. You know, here's the advice. It's not, try it. See what you think. And like I say, when people start to use it, they see the benefits.
Have you been surprised at the breadth of reach that the book has had over the last 13 years or so?
Have I been surprised? Well, yeah. Like I say, when I started out, I really didn't think there was any constituency for this material. So again, when people think of me as shaking my fist at the people below, it's not that at all. I was simply figured there's six of us who care about this material, so I'll put it up, and then the other five will have like a little email pen pal group. So the idea of being able to get this across, and again, over time, it finds its way into the echelons of power. As you gentlemen know, last year, the Fifth Circuit redesigned its opinion, and they used my font, Equity. Not that they could have done anything. The point is, however, the court sat there and had this moment of reflection. Like, a whole bunch of federal justices got together and said, let's do better than we're doing, right? We're publishing these opinions to the public, and let's improve it. And I just think that's great that this kind of attention's being put in. So, I guess there's, you know, on the other hand, there's plenty of courts who've been putting attention to this forever, the U.S. Supreme Court being one of the best examples. Again, to me, I love it when lawyers say, oh, this stuff doesn't matter. And it's like, well, why do you suppose the U.S. Supreme Court spends all this time, you know, on their typography? They have great typography, always have, and that's just how they do things. So you could certainly do worse than follow their example in this case. But yeah, I find more and more, I get these stories from out in the world about, you know, sometimes it's judges, sometimes it's lawyers, you know, nudging for changes in their local rules. But I like to hear that the tide is rising in a certain way. Though I should be clear, if anybody's thinking of asking my help with these, I don't do any lobbying for rules. I'm often, it's like, would you, like, comment on our proposal to do this? And I said, you know what? I've put my material into the world. Please, you're free to cite it, you know, and say, like, Butterick said such and such, if that helps your case. But again, these are your rules in your state or your county. You really need to take the lead in advocating for them. I mean, just having me come in and be like, and so saith Butterick. Again, going back to something I've already said, that's just not my style. That's not how this goes over.
Let's see. So U.S. Supreme Court, are they using Century Schoolbook? What is the font that they use?
It is some form of Century. I think they use one that's actually called Century Expanded. Also the narrower version of the Century family. But that's sort of an interesting example. If you go into the Supreme Court's rules, is it Rule 33, I believe, that controls the form of documents? There's a reference to that you can use any typesetting process, including hot metal. Wow. I wonder how many lawyers read that. Like, what the heck is hot metal typesetting? And for those of you listening who were born after 1930, I guess, I talked about letterpress printing. It was sort of the original form of typesetting where you would cast each individual letter in metal and then set them into rows to make your page. In order to streamline the setting, you had what were called hot metal typesetting machines around the starting in the early part of the 20th century, the Monotype machine and the Linotype machine. Maybe you've heard those names of those companies, but that's what they made. Essentially, there were these, that instead of casting each letter individually, they would sort of have these little molds, and you would kind of key in the characters, and hot molten metal would be shot into these molds. And so essentially your type would be made on demand. You'd print with it, and then you'd put it back in, melt it down, and start all over again. So if you want to use those technologies at the Supreme Court, they are happy to let you do so. I think it's because the U.S. Supreme Court kind of probably went from hot metal typesetting and then just jumped to digital and didn't have the awkward typewriter phase that everybody went through. And I talk about this in the book, that this is not the first person to observe this about typesetting in the computer era, is that it's been so much constrained by what people did with typewriters, because that was what people had before. It's what a lot of people learned to type on and you know, get their keyboard skills. So they turn around to the computer and they just do what they would have done on the typewriter. And of course, that's silly. So there sort of requires this conscious moment of, let's set aside all these typewriter habits, even something, and they still infiltrate. One of my favorite groups of tinfoil hat wearing hate mail people that fill my inbox are the ones who get mad at me on my websites that I don't underline hyperlinks. They think that this is just like the gravest UI sin of the era. So, you know, remember in 1993 when they invented the web and all the links had underlines? I said, but the reason they had underlines is because that was the only form of emphasis that was available on these, you know, earlier computers. And why was it the only form of emphasis? Because it was the only thing on typewriters. So when they made the jump to computers, they sort of emulated the typewriter. Like, we have to stop making all of our typography be a simulation of typewriters. We have to move beyond. So I'm ready, and some will join me, and some will just keep writing hate mail.
I'm happy to tell you that the Texas Supreme Court has recently joined you, and I believe they are using Century Schoolbook as their brand new official court font, issuing court opinions and orders in that format. So, you know, your influence is not only, you know, with the Fifth Circuit, which that's a great thing to have them using your proprietary equity font, but the state Supreme Court here has also felt that influence, and I think is making their orders and opinions much more legible. So I wanted to mention too, Butterick's Practical Typography, which I see described as a web-based book. So how does that site/book relate to typography for lawyers? Is it like an expansion of it, or is it just more of a generalized version of it?
Yes, I remember after I finished, you know, with Jason Wilson, we got the first edition of Typography for Lawyers out the door, and he was, wow, this really came out well. You know, the thing is, you should really do a version of this for, you know, the general public. And I thought, yeah, you know, he's right. It's a good idea. Of course, you know, nothing that I'm talking about here is really specific to lawyers. And so after that, I thought, well, why don't I take this material and try to adapt it to a general audience? So they're sort of whatever sibling sites, if you will. Lawyers, if you want to visit practicaltypography.com, you've seen most of it before. There's a few other. I do more discussion about web page issues. Mm-hmm. Less, the lawyers care less about that, but the general public likes it. That's the answer. They're sort of, they're both derived from a common core of material and tuned slightly to their respective audiences.
Well, it is quite handy to be able to go to practicaltypography.com and see a lot of this stuff right there. I think we should go ahead and we'll do this for you, Matthew, so that you don't feel the need to. But people should note that this is a book that's available for purchase online. Matthew's providing this material out there for you and without requiring you to pay for it, you're through Amazon or something like that before you see it. But it's well worth your time and some value to you. And we'd certainly encourage anybody who's listening to follow through on that and go ahead and pay for it as well.
Why not? I should say that there's the practicaltypography.com, but then Typography for Lawyers also has its dedicated domain, which is typographyforlawyers.com. I should say that on that typographyforlawyers.com website is every single word that's in the book in the same order. It's the entire contents of the book. It's on the website. So there you go. And this is something that I didn't do for the first, I don't know, few years that I had the book out. But it really has not hurt anything. It has not hurt sales. It has not hurt the acceptance of the material. It has really just made it possible for the material to reach more people. There's the students, people in other countries, people in streams. There's all sorts of people who get value out of this. People who can't use printed, you know, books for some reason. So it's fine with me. You know, so I'm happy to have it all online for people to use. And for those who actually want a printed book, there's that too. Yes.
In particular in the law, but I think elsewhere, as we consume so much of our information electronically, and especially in courts that have now gone to only electronic filing, has that changed your views on the way that you do typography and layout?
In the sense of, can you be more specific?
Sure. Just in laying out documents and using certain types and sizes and all of that for the way that a paper brief would look, for instance, that you filed with the court. Now that a lot of courts have mandated electronic filing and aren't reading them in paper anymore, has that changed your views on how you do spacing, font sizes, that kind of thing?
I see what you mean. I think that, in fact, you see more convergence over time because it used to be, you know, say, 20, 25 years ago, for those who remember what computers were like then, you know, screens were much coarser in terms of their pixel resolution. In fact, the first computer I ever had was a Apple Macintosh, right, which had a black and white screen. You know, every pixel was either, you know, not no grayscale, right? It's just, it's either black or white. So it's very coarse. There's no, you know, smooth edges. So if you had to read text on that kind of screen, it was very different. So you would have wanted to make different choices than for a printed page. But what we've seen, and this has really accelerated over the last 10 years, is the adoption of the high DPI screens. And it started on phones and it moved to tablets. I don't know about you two, but I converted to my desktop monitors are now 4K monitors, which to me is just like huge for typography. It's like four times the number of dots on screen. It's beautiful. It's almost like a paper-like resolution. So as we've gotten better and better screen technology, the need to make accommodations in the typography has decreased, if you follow me. So I assume that when, you know, we talk about electronic filing, I mean, what we're doing is we're filing PDFs and judges and their clerks are reading these on. My wife reads PDF transcripts on her iPad and annotates them, for instance, and she loves it. It's much more efficient. So, but it's to her, it's like a alternative paper surface. So there isn't really whatever font that you would like on in print, use that in your electronic filing too. There's no reason not to.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. All right, I want to get into now some of the key rules from the book. And I don't know that the three of us, that there will be much real debate as far as the merits of the rules or not. I have a feeling we'll mostly agree.
But you those listeners that you have to serve, and they're probably eager for you to, you know, take on some of the controversy. So we should really, I don't shy from it. So whatever you want to, you know, they're probably like, you got to ask Bud Eric about that. He's completely wrong about such and such. So I accept it.
Well, I'm going to go a little bit out of order then from the list that I created. And let's go ahead. You've mentioned it. One space between sentences versus two.
Oh, yeah.
That's still a hot button issue, believe it or not.
Why is it a hot button issue? I mean, help me out, because I'm not on appellate Twitter. Who's arguing about this, and what's the other side of the argument here?
I don't know that I can articulate everyone's position, but I think the short answer is there are people that just like more white space between the end of sentences and are for two spaces. And then some that I think just kind of have always done it that way. And so they just want to keep doing it that way.
That's just what they like.
Well, I can tell you as a former two-spacer, it really wasn't difficult for me to make the transition once I saw the difference in how my documents looked. And once I read the book and understood the explanation as to why we had two spaces in the beginning, which goes back to the typewriter, as you've already mentioned. And once I decided that it really was just a wasted space and it didn't add anything, in my view, to readability, it wasn't a difficult choice to make. And now when I see writing that has two spaces between sentences, it bugs me. So Jody, are you a one or a two spacer?
You know, it depends. I've done it both ways. It
depends on the writing. I heard someone give on a podcast recently, I think it was Dwayne Diker from Florida, who has an appellate law podcast, who has a really unique rule about one space in some situations, but two spaces with citations. And that one, I don't think I could get on board with, because I don't want to have to remember that many rules. I just want to hit my space bar and move on to the next sentence.
Well, on the basis of evidence, I won this argument ages ago. And so I don't know what people are pursuing at this point. There's a reason I put this material early on in the book, however, and it's this. Part of my thesis to lawyers is that, like I said before, you are professional publishers. Therefore, your documents are professional printed output, and therefore you should be interested in the typography rules that are used in professional typography. That goes in the introduction of the book. And I can tell, you know, people kind of nod their heads like, okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I say, all right, so thing one, this two spaces thing, like this is just not what is done. Like there is not a single book, newspaper, or magazine you'll ever pick up that has two spaces. So it is kind of a early litmus test to see, okay, I could have told you what my principle is. My principle is we're going to adopt the rules of professional typography wherever we can. And here is one of them. So when people say, I want to use two spaces, like, dude, I don't care what you do. I mean, it's more written. You take the book, you take the material, take whatever you like, leave the rest. Really, I don't care. It's obviously has to reflect what you want to do. But I do think that when people are talking about their special judgment about what's better, I think they're just trying to reject the entire project of the book, you know? And I just, you know, we have all these other, it's sort of silly to compare, but, you know, these other spheres, lawyers are all about arguing from authority is the funny thing, right? Especially appellate lawyers. Like, if you don't have authority, you have nothing. You can't go into court with a brief that's like, as we saw in the, you know, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, it's like, that doesn't exist. You can't use it as authority. So people say, well, I'm not a typographer and I don't know anything about typography, but I have this gut feeling that two spaces look better. It's like, what the heck are you talking about? That style of argument is rejected in every courtroom. It's rejected in pretty much every sphere of public life, though the whole vaccines thing is, you know, getting more popular. It's just, come on. So again, I don't want to engage people because all the evidence is on my side. I just feel like, you know what? Here's the other part. If you want to reject that rule and adopt every other recommendation I make, I'll take that. I'll call that a win. Because I also predict that once you do that, you will come around to the one space thing. It'll take a year or two, but you will come around. So going back to your earlier point, it's a long-term process. People have to come on at their own pace. And, you know, one of my favorite nonsense objections is the one where people say, well, I learned to type on a typewriter. It's like, it's my muscle memory. You ever hear that one? Muscle memory. You know what also happened when you went from a typewriter? Remember, at a typewriter, you had to hit a carriage return at the end of every line. But when we use a word processor, we only hit the carriage return when? At the end of every paragraph. Somehow you overcame that muscle memory. So every single objection, you can just puncture it with this tiniest, dumbest, you know, little pin and let out the air. But again, I don't want to get dragged into that. It's much more interesting and important for me to just to let the material flow. And like I say, to me, like, again, when it's the Central District of California or Eastern District of Texas or Fifth Circuit, you know, when these big court organizations adopt better typography, better fonts, that really sends a powerful message. And again, not a message with my name on it, which is, to me, the best part. Like, I don't want to be the only person. To me, it's much better when there's just more and more voices kind of normalizing this. Like, well, of course we're going to make these documents look good. Why would we make them look ugly? Like, to me, that would be the ultimate success for the material, is that people forget I exist. And it just becomes the norm of good lawyering.
On the subject of attorneys not wanting to change things, you see so many briefs that just sort of use the default system fonts, I think probably both in WordPerfect and in Word. For those who don't maybe want to buy a new font, what are some non-default fonts in those programs that you think present better than, say, you know, your typical Times New Roman or whatever?
Oh, I mean, there's a whole chart of these. Are what you're referring to, I believe, are the system fonts, which is to say the fonts that are installed, you know, on your computer when you get it, or when you get a word processor. Sometimes it comes with, like, I think the Microsoft Office suite has its own fonts. The truth is I have a chart of these, and I've sort of tried to prioritize them in terms of horrible versus not, but every year they change the number added. Like Mac users have a whole different set. So it's not possible for me to keep up with it in the in the way. One that I really like a lot, though, is called Charter. And I mention that because I think it's now a Mac system font. I don't think it's a Windows system font yet, but it's a free font and it's on Practical Typography website. It's totally free and I give it away. I didn't design it. It's designed by a guy named a very esteemed type designer named Matthew Carter, but it was put into the made available under a free license many years ago. And it's just a beautiful font and it just doesn't take much to experiment with this stuff. But again, if somebody wants to just go through and find something, my argument is again, it's not changing the font for the sake of changing the font. It's changing the font for the sake of having that moment of reflection, right? You as a writer have chosen to set your work in a certain face as opposed to just allowing the defaults, right? That's why I say that Times New Roman, it's always been my joke. It's like, it's not a font choice. It's the absence of a font choice. It's the font that was there when you hit new, and it's the font that, you know, you see everybody's been using for the last 60 years. So you're just going to use that. It's not a choice. It's just momentum. And I don't think that that's qualifies as typography. That's just sort of going along with the wave. So like I say, I want legal writers to think of typography as this. Again, it's a small slice of the written product, but in the same way that you think about, you know, how you're going to phrase certain points, you know, what your headings might be, how you're going to order things in the argument. Like, that's, typography deserves to be seen in that sphere. It's not just some purely cosmetic add-on. It's part of the presentation of your argument. And again, in so many other spheres, we as lawyers take the presentation of our argument very seriously. I always, you know, used to joke, like, if you go onto most law firm websites, interested in what your answer is, what do you usually see on the homepage of a law firm website?
Pictures and headlines of all the stuff that the firm's doing.
Right. Scales of justice or lawyer in front of the law library books.
Law libraries. I used to, in LA at least, a lot of, they just show a picture of their office building. Mm-hmm. Like, you should hire us because we spent so much on our office building. And it's so funny to me because what is that if not an argument about the presentation of an art? It's like, here is the physical structure that encloses our lawyers and you should choose us based on that. It's so tall and it's so shiny. And yet there are lawyers in that building who are going to be telling me, this typography, why would anybody want to be interested in the presentation of things? And nobody chooses based on presentation. I mean, that's just, to me, the silliest argument. There's so much in our life where people are weighing the presentation of things. I give an example in the book. And I'm not talking about just sort of, oh yeah, we pay attention to the label on the wine. No, I mean, literally in California, the jury instructions, our jury instructions tell jurors that they can weigh not just the words coming out of a witness's mouth, but their demeanor and how they say things. And they can use that to assess the credibility of a witness. And I stop and I say, what is that? Except, you know, essentially this California juries are part of our jury instructions. The jury members are told that when they're listening to a witness, they, of course, listen to the words coming out of the witness's mouth, but that they are allowed and encouraged to consider the way that the witnesses speaks and, you know, how they present their argument and their demeanor. Essentially, the juries are encouraged to bring all of this presentation of the testimony into their assessment of the truthfulness of it. So it's essentially this direct line is being drawn between how the argument, the testimony is being presented and what its truth value is. So this is an old idea, and I think it's very wrongheaded, which is that somehow the presentation of things and the substance of things just exist on these totally separate planets. They don't. A lawyer's written work is a fusion of text and typography. And again, I am the first person to tell you the typography is just a small little percentage of things, but it is a percentage. And just like the, you know, the clean shirt that you take from the hanger to wear to court that day, instead of pulling one from the bottom of the laundry hamper, that few extra minutes is well worth it. And I think this is, you know, another thing, which is anybody who thinks that this is, you know, it's purely about aesthetics really needs to get into the material, because a lot of what I'm talking about is learning how to kind of structure and format your documents so that it's actually easier to maintain these things. Like, for instance, a silly one that, again, a lot of lawyers don't know, the idea that you can insert a page break in your document, not by pressing the carriage return 100 times, which is a terrible way to do things. Like, once people learn, oh my God, a hard page break, wait, with one character, I can ensure that there's always, you jump to a new page, mind blown. But once you learn that, I call it a trick, I mean, it's been there forever. Once you learn that technique, I'll call it, it saves you time for as long as you know it. So. Mm-hmm. To me, it's not just a question of, is typography worthwhile? It's like, I'm telling you, not only is it worthwhile, but the cost of having typography in your document is really minimal on each incremental document. Once you've set it up, it's always there for you. Once you've kind of versed yourself in these techniques, it's always available to you. So again, if having nice typography every time is no more expensive than having horrifying typography, why didn't you choose the nice typography?
Sure.
Many still do, but there you go. It's part of the pitch.
Well, another topic that gets discussed pretty frequently over in appellate Twitter land is the use of dashes. And you make the point in the book about hyphens being mistakenly used or erroneously used in place of dashes. Do you have a refresher for us on the circumstances under which a N-dash or an M-dash ought to be used and why people should forget about hyphens?
Well, again, this is another topic that I don't think anybody, like, I'm not putting anybody in the typography jail for this. I'm going to come back to your question, but I want to say something that if I were truly the king of typography, which I'm not, and I had a magic wand to make everybody obey my will, which I don't, but if I did have it and I had one wish, the one wish that I would make would have nothing to do with word spaces after a sentence. It would have nothing to do with hyphens and end dashes. It would have everything to do with eliminating the overuse of capital letters. Like that is a horrible scourge. And the reason is because it's often used as a technique for emphasis or for calling attention to something. Like, this is important. I want you to pay attention to it. But here's the irony. When you set something in all caps, it actually makes it harder to read. It actually makes people run away or, you know, skip over it, which is the opposite of what you want. It's actively self-defeating typography. And there's a great opinion that was came out of the Ninth Circuit some years ago where some lawyers were there saying, because in the UCC, there's various rules related to conspicuous text. And the lawyers were arguing, well, we had, you know, whatever, all these acres of capitalized, you know, all caps text. Of course it was conspicuous. And the judge wrote, the lawyers have to learn that their caps lock key is not an instant make conspicuous button. And it's like, that's a great lesson, right? There's more to it. You can't just put things in caps. You have to sort of think about the context. So getting back to your question about hyphens and dashes. Well, my advice about hyphens and dashes is taken right out of Brian Garner's books, which is that an N dash, which is longer than a hyphen. The hyphen is the shortest. The N dash, E-N, is the sort of middle one. And then there's the longest one of all is called the M dash, E-M. So how would we use these? Like the hyphen is the one that you see at the end of a sentence when you have a word that's broken between two lines. The N dash is usually the one you want to use when you have two names or a contrast between things like Arizona, California reciprocity, or if you want to have a range of numbers, like a sentence of 5 to 8 years, right? In that context, you want an N-EN. And then the longest one, the M-dash, that's the one that you use to set off separate phrases from the flow of the text. So again, I don't think anybody's going into the typographic pokey, but one thing I would like is often lawyers will use two hyphens in a row to signify an N-dash or an M-dash. Now, that I don't like, and that's because it's a typewriter habit. Typewriters did not have dash characters on them. So again, people simulated them by typing two hyphens in a row. I understand where the habit came from, but guess what? You have a beautiful computer in front of you that's happy to make a dash character. You just have to ask for it. So if you find yourself ever in your life typing two hyphens in a row, take a moment, find out where the dash is and use it.
Of course, in the best worlds, typing two hyphens on your computer will automatically convert into an M dash.
Yes,
if you've got the shortcuts properly programmed.
The shortcuts can have unintended consequences. And one of my favorites being that in I believe it's Microsoft Word, if you type left parenthesis, lowercase c, right parenthesis, it will substitute what? A copyright
symbol. Copyright.
Right. The problem is that you also can experience that sequence of characters if in an outline, right? If you're referring to a subsection of like some law, penal code 1101, subsection, open paren, C, close paren. And then, you know, you go back and look, it's like, why is there a copyright symbol in the middle of it? So these substitute, I'm not trying to create, you know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, but it can be good simply to learn the direct way of inserting some of these characters and not necessarily relying on substitute. Mm-hmm.
Although if you back up, once your open paren C, close paren has inadvertently created the copyright signal, if you just hit the backspace or delete button once, it'll revert, I've learned.
That's true.
That doesn't help you in an outline necessarily, but.
You mentioned all caps. One thing I was going to talk about briefly was emphasis. I feel like I see a lot of briefing these days where people sort of do a belt, suspenders, and top hat approach. They'll bold, they'll underline. They'll italicize all together. And to me, that is almost like you're screaming at the court, look at this, look at this. And where do you come down on maybe a good way to sort of emphasize gently?
Well, where I come down is that when you start combining all of these techniques for emphasis, you'd kind of paint yourself into this corner where everything is very loud. I mean, in the book, I'm a huge fan of white space, right? People want to make their headings more obvious to the reader. How about two, you know, I'll set it instead of 12 point, I'll set it in 15 point. I'll make it bold and italics. Like, you don't have to do anything to that. You can just leave more white space above and below it. That will also set it apart from the other things on the page without adding a single black mark, you know what I mean, anymore. So I think that, yes, emphasis is overused. That said, however, I have absolutely heard from lawyers who are like, well, you know, Matthew, it's your whole sort of subtle emphasis thing is very interesting and all, but when I go into court, I make all of my headings bold and italic and underlined, and I win all my cases. And All right, man, you know, keep doing what's working. I mean, this is another age-old fallacy, which is hard to get around. You know, people object to certain material and they say, yes, but you see, Matthew, you're wrong about this because that's not what judges want. And I'm like, oh, what do judges want? Well, they want, and it turns out the person describes it like they turns out that all judges want exactly what this person wants. Okay. There's this weird myopia that goes on where, and you know, judges are all different people. They have all different preferences. There's no way to generalize like that. So I just say, okay, if you need that justification to keep doing whatever it is you're doing, that's fine. I'm not trying to make people lose their cases. Some people are just fearful, right? They think if they, and this isn't true. This isn't just restricted to typography. This is restricted to all sorts of things in the practice of law. You know, if there's like some, you know how it is, and there's whatever forms or you know, certain motions, there's little turns of phrase people use. Nobody really remembers why they use these turns of phrase. They just do it. Or in California, like everybody puts these double lines on the left margin of their page. There's no court rule that says that those need to be there, but nobody does it. Why? Well, because the last person did it. So there's these, again, momentum, tradition. People don't really want to scrutinize. It was interesting to be doing this work at the beginning of my law career, because as a new lawyer, you're always scared of, well, I was always scared of screwing up. So I was always making sure that I read all the rules, you know, one time, two times. Mm-hmm. Needless to say, many of the rules were not what my supervising lawyer said they were, right? He had been practicing for 20 years and he, you know, some things he misremembered, some things that honestly changed. It was, you know, he was right, but now he's wrong. And it's like, he was very resistant at times. And I'd be like, well, sir, I mean, look right here. And he'd still say, well, we're going to do it the old way. You know, it's just like, that's what the judge, it's just funny sometimes how much resistance there can be to this. So again, none of this material is a pressure march. I invite people to take as little or as much as they want and see what the result is. And again, I am not lying to you. Nobody has ever come to me and said something bad has happened. One of my favorite messages, however, maybe it's kind of coming full circle. There's a longtime fan who's been early adopter of my fonts, and he was litigating a case, I think in Michigan, against the state of Michigan. And he's like, this is great. I'm going to go into the court. And he, for many years, he'd been very excited because he always had the best looking documents and he always got compliments, you know, and he was using one of my fonts, I think it was Equity. And he arrives for this court case and he gets the briefing from the state of Michigan side. And in this case, the state lawyer had gotten another one of my fonts called Century Super. He's like, oh, God, that Bunnick fonts. He's like, I finally met my match. And I said, oh, Orm, I'm sorry. It's not your secret weapon anymore. The secret's out.
That's great. Well, I've got a couple more of the key rules that I want to just ask you about real quick. And then we've got some other, just a few more questions after that before we wrap up. These are also things that I see, at least one of them, talked about online sometimes. And that is, use turning on hyphenation with justified text. Is the idea there just to keep the justified text from spreading out across the page any more than necessary? Because, you know, you get all that white space, and white space is good, right? But not when suddenly the words are disproportionately spaced. Is that where this comes from?
Well, you're speaking about an internet argument, thing one. I mean, there are, what I learned sometimes the hard way is there are certain topics that people love to argue about online. They're not really, you know, people call them, there's a debate about such and such. It's like, no, it's like a social media fight. Nobody else anywhere is debating this. It's just something that y'all are really into debating. And I'm not trying to pry it from your fingers, but I just like to set out the difference between something that's just like a social media phenomenon versus not. So yeah, that's another one I don't understand. What's the argument against it? If you're going to use, and let's just be clear, there's sort of four common alignments for a block of text in your word processor. There's left aligned, where every line starts at the left edge and sort of ends wherever. So you have a ragged right edge. Then you have right aligned, which is the opposite of that. There's no reason to ever use right aligned. We don't do that. And then there's centered. Sometimes we use centered text for a title or a heading or something, though we should use it sparingly. And then you have justified. And in justified, the line that you would have had is stretched, right? So that the left and right ends of the line go to the edges of the page. And that's the technique that is often used in a lot of professional type setting, whether it's books or newspapers or magazines. A lot of the blocks of text you see will be justified. Okay, so fine. I want that to be an option for lawyers. But I said, there's one thing. You have to hyphenate. Why? Because if you don't, essentially you're creating, when you're justifying a line of text, you're pulling the words apart. So more space is introduced between words. So if you refuse hyphenation, essentially you can have these awkward line breaks. And then when you introduce these spaces, the spaces can be just enormous. And I give a visual example in the book or on typographyforlawyers.com. It's right there. You can see it for yourself. Again, I don't know how this can possibly be a debate, because if you look at the two options, it's like one of them is horrific, you know? Now, I should also note that using left aligned is fine too. And it doesn't have this problem because essentially all the extra slop space just stays on the right side of the line. So all the word spaces in between are the same. So you don't have this variable spacing problem. I actually don't like to use justified text in a word processor because I find that it doesn't really do a good job. If you are a professional designer with access to a professional layout program, like whether it's Adobe InDesign or Affinity Designer, you know, these programs have better algorithms for doing justification and can kind of do a nicer job making everything even. But I would rather just make it left aligned. Again, I leave the choice to lawyers, but like I say, if you're going to justify, please turn on hyphenation. Like you say, some just think they shouldn't have to. And it's not, you. Here's how many times you see me striding onto Twitter to argue with people. Never. It never happens. I can't do that.
And this is more for my purposes, is just of a reminder, because I just caught it, this error in one of the briefs of mine that I was rereading recently. And that is putting a non-breaking space after a paragraph or section symbol. And I think the logic behind this, I agree with this 100%, but sometimes I just forget to do it. And so when I go back and read the text later, I see that sort of hanging section symbol or hanging paragraph symbol at the end of the line. And I just keep thinking to myself, gosh, I need to figure out a way to automate that so I don't forget.
Right. And to be clear, you know, so those who haven't heard of the non-breaking space, it's essentially a thing that looks exactly like a space. It's the same width. It's the same color. Joking there, it doesn't print. But instead of allowing a line break to happen at that juncture, it keeps everything together. And, you know, as Todd was saying, when you have a citation like a section reference or a paragraph reference, or, you know, other types of things, maybe even like a title, Mr. or Dr. or Ms., you'd want to keep it with the name. If you use a type of non-breaking space, which is a special character you type, it's a signal to your word processor. It's like, don't allow an actual line break to happen. Make sure these pieces are always kept together. And it doesn't come up that often. It's just more of a thing to know about. It's like the hard page break. It's like, it's something to add to your toolbox if you like it. It doesn't really change the visual outcome. It's more of a, whatever you want to call it, document engineering tip. So There you go.
What's your advice to lawyers who would like to use custom fonts, Equity, for example, but are worried about exchanging documents with lawyers who don't have those fonts?
I think that's a legitimate concern, probably the number one concern that lawyers have. Unfortunately, word processors, file formats, I mean, this is a restriction that exists way above my pay grade as a digital person. Word processors have never been able to embed fonts into their documents the way that, say, PDF can. If you use a custom font in your document and you make a PDF, what happens is a copy of the font actually is inserted into the PDF and travels with that document forever. So it ensures that the text always is displayed in the font because the font is right there. That's not true with ordinary word processing documents. If you send, say, a opposing counsel, you know, you're working on a settlement agreement, you send a doc or a docx of the settlement agreement, the fonts don't travel with it. So if you've used a custom font, when the person on the other side opens it up, they're not going to see that custom font. And again, I don't control that. That has been the case for decades. I wish it weren't the case. I wish they had made it a different decision, but I guess it seemed like a good idea in 1984. So we're stuck with it. I joke about typewriter history influencing today's typography. I mean, certainly the early history of the personal computer also influences it. So, you know, there's a lot of sort of dumb things that are left over, but we do our best. So the advice I would have is I say, look, you know, for instance, to people who are Equity customers, I say, you know, Equity was designed to lay out almost the same as Times New Roman. So if you weren't, use Times Roman for your draft document. Everybody has that. And then when you get the final thing, just switch it to Equity and it'll lay out almost exactly the same and it'll look nice. Now, is that cheating? It's like, no, that's pretty much how every document is made, you know, in other arenas. You know, it's the layout doesn't happen until the final stage. So yeah, my advice is like, don't worry about it until And on the other hand, some lawyers say, but why would I even want, the whole point of having my cool font is so that the opposing counsel will be like completely blown away by it. And I said, well, in that case, yeah, it's hard. It's hard.
Well, that's a practical tip. You know, it can be done. It involves a little more massaging of the document on your end once it comes back, if someone's redlining, say a client, for example.
Yes, I suppose that's true. I mean, on the other hand, like plenty of organizations have adopted these fonts, and so there's clearly ways to handle it too. So, you know, but again, I appreciate what people are saying, and I always, you know, I always want to be practical about my advice to lawyers. I talk about let's use the rules from professional typography, and that's great up to a point, right? There's always a cost benefit analysis, and I don't want people to think, oh, Butterick's out here with a bunch of like really fiddly, weird stuff. I mean, some of it's fiddly and weird, but you don't have to get that deep if you don't want to. Some of it is also just basic blocking and tackling. It's easy. I mean, you know, we haven't really talked about the, you know, the kind of the four key things when I speak of in the book. I say, listen, there's four considerations that are fundamental to how your document works. One is the font choice. One is the line spacing. One is the line length or page margins, which is a different way of looking at it. And then the other is the point size of the font. Just those four considerations, that's like 90% of the typography of your document. And those aren't hard to understand or fiddly. And moreover, I give, you know, some ranges that you can work in. So it's like, I always say, just focus on those four things if you focus on nothing else. Work on those four things first. And maybe that's all you do. Maybe that's where you stop. And that was great because you're so far ahead now. Line length in particular is like something that's like a huge differentiator. People they think about it, but you know, when these lines of text get too long, they just get weirdly tiring to move your eye from the end of one line to the beginning of the next. And again, I always say, like, go look at magazines, books, and newspapers. They do not use excessively long lines. So I'm big on you know, text blocks that are a little more compact. Or we'll look at, again, the U.S. Supreme Court's opinions. Great example where we still use tend toward these document layouts that look like they could have been done on typewriters with the lines far apart and so on. And again, there's lawyers who will say, well, yeah, but that's what the court wants. Yes, maybe there are court rules that require that. But guess what? Then there's all the other documents that you make in the course of, you know, whether it's memos, whether it's letters, whether it's this or it's that. And in that case, you don't have to make them look like typewriters. So, and you know, typography can make a difference in all those contexts as well. So I encourage people to think, and I think about it this way. It's like, do what you can, where you can. Don't just kind of throw up your hands and say, well, I can't do everything all the time. Therefore, none of this is worth. No, it's not that at all. It's about adding as much typography to the situation as you can.
I just out of curiosity, for my own knowledge, how do you come up with the names for your fonts?
You know, the name Equity, I came up with that while bike riding through Los Angeles. I was going to lunch and I had been working on the font. I was trying to think, I like something short. And I came over and there's a building and it literally had the word Equitable on it. I think it's the Equitable Insurance Company. I'm like, Equitable, that would be a great name. And then the next day I thought, but you know what would be a better name? Equity. That's part of the sort of marketing alchemy. I like short names. I like names that are easy to spell. I mean, in typography, we have a lot of fonts already. So one of the challenges is just finding a name that hasn't been used. You know, Equity was such a great little discovery, you know, for a font that was made for lawyers initially. And so I had to use it.
I love it. I love the fact that there are courts out there that have Equity as their default font. I mean, that's great. That totally fits. Well, our kind of tradition as we wrap up is to ask our guests for a tip or a war story. And you've given, an episode chock full of tips. I don't know if you have another one or if you have a war story or anything you'd like to share.
Part of what I like about doing what I do is that it's fun to do something that's not partisan. You know what I mean? It's everybody can benefit from this material I don't mind that people have these debates. I mean, I'd rather that they debate over whether to use a hyphen or an end dash versus many other things. So I'm grateful that lawyers have been picking up this material. And like I say, it's been fun to hear from, say, people in law school. And then, you know, 5 years later, they're in their first job. And then a few years after that, they're in a firm. Just hearing from people how the material really does improve things for them. And almost the shock that they feel when they really start to both get it on their own, realizing that moment of, wow, like, this is not beyond me. And this is an important point I make to lawyers too. It's like, it's within your grasp. I don't want to call it easy. It isn't necessarily easy. It requires a little bit of training your eye and training your mind. But once you pick it up, it really just becomes a great tool. I mean, it's like, you know, what Brian Garner's books do for lawyers in terms of sharing is like, here's some ways to think about how you use language that are going to help you be a more effective communicator. So to me, it makes me really happy that lawyers can find a place for this. And again, you know, appellate lawyers, most of all, I mean, I understand why they like the material and I'm totally grateful for it. I hope it continues to be an engine of power.
Well, Matthew, you've been so generous with your time today. It's really interesting to hear your personal views on some of these things. And we just really appreciate you coming on. Thanks for spending time with us.
Oh, my pleasure. And then thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.